My name is Roy Malloy, and you are listening to a podcast that I have humbly called The Dawn of Crime, named after the book series by the same title, biographying and talking about people who have come and gone and contributed their dodgy, sketchy things to history by being crooks in a lot of ways. And this guy is no exception at all. This is a guy called Alfred Thomas Barber, but this edition of The Dawn of Crime is dedicated to a friend of mine. I believe his rank is corporal. I'm going to say corporal, maybe major. I'm going to say corporal. A fellow in the Defence Force is called Corporal Corey Tomlins. And this episode of The Dawn of Crime is dedicated to him because it's an episode all about stolen valour. If you're not familiar with stolen valour, we've all heard a lot about it in the last maybe 5 or 6 years. It's been hitting the news, but this is where you get somebody who pretends to be an ex-serviceman. This story is about a guy who did exactly that, but it was just a lifelong ambition of his. But you get to really see how and why this guy becomes this way in a small part. Doesn't excuse his actions, but he wasn't just somebody who dressed up as somebody from the military. It kind of overlaps to a whole bunch of straight-up crookery. That's the word for a crookery. It's a technical expression for a crook who repeatedly crooks. So this story begins in 1895, right at the middle of a global depression, and Alf Barber, he was the son of a veteran himself, so his dad had served king and country. Yeah, he was from a very big family in a country town, and pretty normal affair. He's a Catholic kid, one of six, and he lived in a town called Malden in Victoria. If you've never been to Malden, it's one of those interesting places because the town itself seems to have been preserved exactly as it was at the time he was alive. So since the 1880s or 90s, not a lot of civics have happened. They've got those great big deep stone gutters. The shops, by and large, haven't been renovated. And it's a picturesque, gold rush style looking town. So it's easy enough to imagine when you go to Malden what it would have been like when Alf Barber was there. So Alf is born one of six children, and he's raised in Malden. But it's a sleepy town, and this is a time, by the time he's 20, 1915, where things are starting to come back online financially for the world. And it just seems to him that Malden isn't fast-paced enough. So he headed to Melbourne on day trips initially. The train line reached Malden. And he heads to Melbourne and he discovers Little Lonsdale Street, which is a red light district. And he discovers St Kilda's seaside dance halls, including the Palais de Dance. And it fills him with enthusiasm for living in the city. And that's okay, I guess. That's a normal enough aspiration. But it seems to be a missing link between his ability to get there and all the things that are tying him to Malden. He also, I couldn't nail this, but I kept getting glimpses that he perhaps had family who were wealthy in and around that area. So it's not just enough that he lives in Malden. I believe he had reasons that stopped him from going to Melbourne. Maybe it's that somebody thought that he would inherit something. It's hard to tell. But certainly he is stuck in Malden. Right. He works for a shoemaker and he's selling shoes in Malden. 1914, he's heading to one of his trips to Melbourne, and he's with a mate. They stop off in a town called Castlemaine. Castlemaine is relatively large, particularly in comparison to Malden, and they're heading to Melbourne via train, and they get off at Castlemaine. And they're walking around the town, and he sees a bottle shop, and they head inside. In the bottle shop, there's a display, which is a wicker basket. It's got a hand-painted sign above it, and there's a special on the bottles that are displayed in it. And according to the friend, it was like a switch went off, and Barber looks at these bottles, and he can't stop talking about them. But at the same time, he doesn't have the money to buy them. And so he seems to kind of fixate. This becomes a theme with Barber. He gets an idea and he can't stop fixating on it. And so he more or less just grabs the two bottles and shoves them loosely under his jacket and walks out. It was completely visible to the guy who owned the shop. I mean, it was the worst shoplifting in the history of terrible shoplifting. But that's how it happens. So this fellow watches him, follows him, locks up the shop, walks behind them, watches them get on the train, and then rushes to the police station and says, look, just so you know, these guys have just stolen three bottles of alcohol. The police at the time had telephone. It was a new kind of thing. And so they got on the telephone, they rung the next town down, and they said, go pull these guys off the train. So they did, and they were brought back to Castlemaine. And Barber, by this stage, was beside himself with anxiety and, you know, terror. And he said to the police, look, can I just pay for the bottles? I've got the money, I'll pay for the bottles. And they said, nah, sorry, mate, you're going to go for this. So they put him in front of a judge. Now, this is one of those rare moments where the judge is incredibly kind. He says to Barber, look, I don't want to see you go to jail for this. You seem like you're from a good family. His mum was recorded in the newspapers as sitting there really sobbing in court. She was really emotionally upset. She was humiliated. And I also should point out at this point, when you're researching, probably due to the very small population in Australia at the time, if you're researching newspaper articles from about 1900, almost every court case is in the newspapers. I mean, these days, right, there are so many, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of court cases of shoplifting every day. I just literally cannot imagine a shoplifting case today being in the newspapers. But almost every single one was. So this guy, his newspapers have written about, this guy stole three bottles of booze and his mum was crying. So that's actually in the newspapers. So the judge said to him, look, what I'm going to do, instead of sending you to jail, I'm going to make you sign the pledge. Now, the pledge was a promise to not drink. So he signs this personal undertaking to never drink again. And he was fined a £15 bond. And that money would be given back to them in 12 months if he didn't reoffend. So £15, that's a lot of money. It's like it's in the thousands of dollars of worth today in 2020. So they've handed over a huge amount of money on the prospect that this guy's going to do the right thing. He left the courthouse with mum. I guess he was feeling incredibly flat. However, only a year later, 1916, so 18 months later, boredom seems to have overtaken him, and I guess they got the bond back, is the point. But he starts again, almost as soon as that duration is up, he starts heading back to Melbourne. And he's hitting the sly grog shops and the brothels of Little Lonsdale. And he's really enjoying this incredible North Fitzroy lifestyle North Fitzroy is still known for fascinating and artistic places, and it was then too, but back then it wasn't so much art, it was sly grog, opium, cocaine, and he was just into all of it. So World War I begun right about that point, and it gave him the opportunity to become the big guy that he always thought he was going to be. Now, he's still trying to fund a lifestyle that he can't afford, and so what he does is he's working in this boot shop in Malden. And there's a very wealthy, affluent local town bloke who he's well known to them. Now, I wasn't sure if this guy was a relative of Barber at all, but he certainly, he knows this guy well enough. It seems to me that when I was trying to research it, this name kept coming up again and again, right? And so he knows this very affluent fella in a town not far from where they're from. And he boasts, oh, I wouldn't buy my boots from you. I only get them from, you know, this particular bootmaker in town, in Melbourne. So he's got a knowledge of boots. And this fella's name is Hannon, Mr. Hannon. And Hannon is wealthy. And he only buys his boots from Dory and Tilly's Warehouse in Melbourne. And that's a long way to go for boots. These boots are the kind of thing also that will sell for, you know, quite a lot of money. In fact, you could even buy them in Melbourne, take them back to the country, and you'd sell them for more. So Barber has this idea. He heads to Melbourne on one of his jaunts, and he heads into Dorian Tilly's warehouse, and he said, look, I'm here on behalf of Mr. Hannon, who wants 5 different pairs of boots in different styles, all in his sight. I'm going to take them back to him. He will choose one pair. I'll bring the other 4 back, and I'll pay you for the pair he chooses. And they say, oh, well, okay, he's a known customer. Seems right. Here's the 5 pairs of boots. So then Barber goes more or less around the corner. I mean, I've done the distance on this, and it's probably within 2 city blocks. He walks around the corner to a Russell Street pawnbroker, I think. You know, it's like that kind of place. And the fellow, his name is Bernard Harris, and he's 161 Russell Street. And he sells these boots to this guy for cash. Now, these are very, you know, they're stylish. They're boots that will resell. But one of the workers from Hannon's who'd given him the boots... One of the guys who works at Dorian Tilly's warehouse walks past the pawnbrokers on Russell Street in the morning on his way to work, and he sees these same 5 pairs of boots in the window for sale. So Barber ends up back in court. Now, at this point, he'd been telling people widely that he was a returned soldier. The war was underway, and he'd always had this fascination with being a soldier. When he was younger, like in his teens, he did cadets, and he hated it. Hated doing cadets. He avoided it like the plague, so much so that he had a particular amount of hours he had to accrue, and they realized that he was wagging. Wagging, if you're not from Australia, wagging means, you know, dodging. They shipped him off down to Queenscliff, which is a fair way down the coast, to a military base where he couldn't escape, so he would do his parade hours. So he'd hated doing military service when he was a teenager. But now that he realized that people would pay attention to him if he told them that he was a returned soldier, he did almost nothing but that. He'd get around Little Lonsdale Street, and he was telling people that he was a recruiting sergeant for the armed forces, and also that he was a returned soldier. When he got to court for selling these boots, he told them he was also confronted by a lady who said that she'd been fleeced for £3 by Alf. So the charges start mounting up pretty quickly. He did his best to find work in the lead up, but he was sent to prison, and he got 3 months for the boot theft, and also subsequently for stealing £3. So he did 3 months in prison. And they went by kind of unremarkably. On his prison record, it doesn't show that he does a whole lot in jail. Like, he doesn't rub the establishment the wrong way. He just does his time, puts his head down, and he gets released. But he really doesn't do a lot when he comes out of jail. He certainly doesn't go home. Seems to stay in St Kilda. By 1917, he's got nothing going for him. And he held down a job for a very short time. But August the following year, he found himself in front of a judge again for breaking and entering. Now, this is where it starts to become a bit real for him. He was caught stealing from a home from a lady called Helen Lloyd at 3 Royal Crescent in Armidale. The house had one of those typical wide verandas. It's an Edwardian-style house with windows that, you know, kind of... Really, you can stand out the front of these windows and see everything inside the room, those great big windows. And it just seemed too much for him to resist. Now, I assume he'd cased the joint first. Maybe not. Maybe he was just walking past. But unfortunately for Alf, Helen was home at the time. So he's not a very good thief. But he got into her house, and she asked him, she said to him, you know, what are you doing in here? He said, oh, I thought this was a doctor's surgery. I've been trying to find my doctor. And I thought, now, for those of you who are listening who may not be old enough to remember, it was actually a reasonably common thing until about maybe the late 80s, 1980s, late 1990s. It was common to find dentists and doctors who'd taken the lease on a house or bought a house just in the suburbs, normal house, on a street, and converted it into a doctor's surgery or a dental surgery. So there you'll be, sitting in a dentist chair in a room that used to be someone's bedroom, legit. So anyway, that's what he's looking for, is a doctor's surgery that he believes is located nearby. She said, well, this isn't it. And he went, okay, bye, walked off. You know. So she traced his footsteps back to the bedroom. She discovered that a whole bunch of stuff was missing, gold brooches and silver. And so she called the police and they came by. They did the area and found Alf like literally a few houses away, doing the same thing. So in court, he claimed that he couldn't have been there that day, breaking into Three Royal Crescent, because he was at a military drill for the Navy Reserve. So they said, okay, can you prove this? His response was pretty standard. He couldn't, so he withdrew the claim. In court, the arrest of Alf, it shows a whole bunch of things about his mental state. He jumps all around the place, but at this stage, when they start arresting him, you also start to see, they write down what they observe in him, and they note that he's wearing military medals. He told the policeman at first that he'd been at Gallipoli, and he was sent home due to fever. So the policeman examined the medal that he was wearing and pointed out to Alf, the name that they stamped around the perimeter of the coin, the medal itself, wasn't his name. He backpedaled pretty quickly and he said, oh yeah, well, I bought it at a pub. Turns out that he'd stolen it from a guy at a pub who'd passed out. So things are starting to look pretty sketchy for Alf. He's out there telling people that he's a returned soldier because it gets him a lot more leeway, particularly if he gets done for crookery, for stealing. But he's able to try and worm his way until he gets in front of police, and then they really understand what's happened to him. And they know he's a crook, he's stealing valour, and he really needs to be in jail. His prison record again, he gets prison time, he gets 18 months for this. And 18 months later, sure enough, he's back in St Kilda. And he's trying his best to... for a very short time, he tries his best to get a job and settle down, but it really doesn't take him very long. It's like weeks this time before he starts casing joints, houses. The occupants of this next house, whether he'd gotten away with other ones previously or not, but the first time he's caught after he serves an 18-month jail prison sentence, the occupants arrived home just as he got there, as he was coming out of the house. So Alf Barber was stealing things from the house again. The occupants came home and found him, and they chased him. A passing motorcyclist chased him down the street, and he's on foot being chased by a guy on a motorcycle. The motorcyclist cuts him off and grabs him. So he's taken down to the St Kilda Road police station, and he's charged with not only burglary, but also for wearing a military campaign medal. Now, this is a well-known enough phenomena at the time that they've got a fine in place for it. He appealed the two-year sentence, and he had it reduced to at least 1 year, so he's now going to do a year in jail. But serving time started to take its toll on him this time, and where in the past he hadn't been, he hadn't been noted for any misbehaviour in prison, he starts getting noted in his prison record for fighting. And it's probably the fact that he's been in jail enough that he's testing his luck in there and getting belted as well. So he returned to prison from 1933 to 1935, and he was serving time in Pentridge and Geelong prisons for theft. As each year in prison grew longer for Alf, he kind of became a harder guy, and he came out seeming that way as well. He was finally freed in 1934 at the age of 50, and he was pictured in his final mugshot looking a little bit older and worse for wear. He was hardened, and he certainly didn't look like he was... I don't know, it's hard to say. I'll post the picture as a thumbnail of this piece, and that'll be the last picture of him taken in his prison mugshot, and it shows you a harder, kind of older guy. He spends the rest of his days living in a suburb of Melbourne, where he kind of just shuffles to the pub every day. But he'd continue to wear campaign medals from Gallipoli, and he'd tell people that he'd been there and, you know, tell stories at the pub, which, you know, was far more common. But he passed away in Preston at the age of 72, after being called out numerous times for stolen valour, but didn't seem to stop him after being fined and jailed for the offence. So Alf Barber was one of those guys who isn't just a crook and a cretin, but he's also somebody that just would not learn from it and was addicted to the gratitude and fame that should be given only to soldiers. My name has been Roy Malloy. This story has been dedicated to, I'm going to say, General Corey Tomlins and in the Australian Defence Forces. If you want to know more about any of these stories, check out the book series in the same title. There's three books in the series now called The Dawn of Crime. They're available online by Roy Malloy, or check out my author page on Facebook, which is Roy Malloy Author.